Creek, a novel read by the author Paula Coomer and brought to you by KRFP in Moscow, Idaho.
Mystery, mystery, behind the veil, surprise me. Confound me. Surround me.
This is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either products of the author's imagination or used in a fictional way. Any resemblance to actual locales or persons, living or dead, is entirely coincidental.
These are the words of Chief Sealth, as spoken at Point Elliott Treaty Grounds, January 23, 1855. When the red man shall have perished from this earth, and the memory of my tribe shall have become a myth among the white men, these shores will swarm with the invisible dead of my tribe. And when your children's children think themselves alone in the field, the store, the shop, upon the highway, or in the silence of these pathless woods, they will not be alone. In all the earth, there is no place dedicated to solitude. At night, when the streets of your cities and villages are silent and you think them deserted, they will throng with the returning hosts that once filled and still love this beautiful land. The white man will never be alone. Let him be just and deal kindly with my people, for the dead are not powerless. Dead, did I say? There is no death, only a change of worlds. The Good Red Road, West. Eastward I go only by force, but westward I go free. Henry David Thoreau. Ex Orient Lux, Ex Orient Frux. From the East Light, from the West Fruit. May 23rd, 2001, Eagle Cap Wilderness, Oregon. People are really something. The way they act as if they know what's best for me. Telling me, just because I'm a woman, I ought to be afraid of being alone in the wilderness. How many nights have I spent on this very spot in the last 16 years? Never alone, maybe, but it's not as if I haven't experienced isolation, and not one of them with sufficient love for the place to explain it the way I can. Mosquitoes losing spunk with sundown's chill temperatures. Conifers already smelling like sweet green hashish, thanks to a string of early hot days. The Lostine River, burdened with fresh snowmelt between root-infested banks, her skin sparkling, dusky, fast. A river moving cold and deep enough to make fording it a fool's gamble. Nonetheless, here I stand, bad as a kid, longing for that silt-edge expanse of beach on the opposite bank when I've got one just like it at my feet. But I'd love to sit over there looking back at myself, decide what my camp preparations say about me, to have the late sun illuminate what I hope to retrieve from these mountains, maybe even lend shape to the question bag I bring. But I suppose anybody who knows me might remind me I don't need to wade ice water to learn what I've already lived, since here is a ghost scene from mine and Mark's marriage, a place of grilled trout, coyote impressions, Kmart sleeping bags, a place of squeal-laced river baths and boxed wine and ceramic coffee cups. A place where my oldest son, Brett, once tiptoed away at dawn, taking his pint-sized rod and reel and a nightcrawler to the water to catch a perfect Dolly Varden for breakfast. an act of such self-sufficiency as to make Mark slap him a high five and say, "Attaboy!" Even Zach, his 3-year-old brother, pulled at his t-shirt until the threads popped. He was so impressed by the feat. As for me, I made myself busy firing the camp stove, head down and silent, so Mark wouldn't harass me about being oversensitive. In 3 months, that daring fisherman will hit 21. 3 months more, and my youngest will turn 18. But I've not come here to wallow in my empty nest. I'm ready to be done with the nightmare of single parenting, the visitations, the swapping custody, that exquisite sword known as child support, the constant whiplash of emotions daring me to commit either abuse or neglect, and my poor sons lashing at windmills and brawling over neighborhood vendettas, damaged psyches endlessly retaliating against enemies their father and I created. Don't get me wrong, I'm glad we made it this far, and at least none of us is left in a vegetative state, and I'm sure I will look back on this not as the end of an era, rather the beginning of a new life. But as they leave this year to go to college, Brett getting a late liftoff, I find myself angry, furious in fact, for the injustices Mark or fate or whatever it was wrought against me in my own gentle youth, for suckering me into conceiving because I loved his snowy blue eyes, for baby diapers and bottles and tonsillectomies and 10 days in the pediatric ICU watching IV antibiotics scoot through a tube into Zach's scalp 6 months after he was born. "Thank goodness you brought him in when you did," the doctor said during that emergency room visit. "Parents tend to ignore symptoms until it's too late. Zach would require surgery, but the infection was isolated to his left shoulder when it might have chosen his spinal cord or his brain. Luckily, babies are vaccinated against Haemophilus influenza these days." But recounting those long nights spent waiting to see whether my baby was going to live or die doesn't make me any less pissed at any of them right now for having left me, Mark all cozied up to a new wife, both boys with jobs and driver's licenses and serious girlfriends and virtually no need for me. My heart feels dark and sinister, and I run around thinking, "That's it, to hell with them. I never wanted this mess, and now it's done and over, that's all." Not to mention the fact that I spent 11 years in the pursuit and execution of a nursing career thanks to that detailed hospital visit. It had to do with watching the world from inside a glass-walled isolation room, breastfeeding and rocking my baby for 10 days of naps and nights. In my line of vision, an abandoned hydrocephalic 3-month-old whose head circumference rose and fell like a barometer. My good friend Ellen Barton recently sent a quotation from Rainer Maria Rilke, who said to have patience with everything unresolved in your heart and try to love the questions themselves as if they were locked rooms or books written in a fancy foreign language. She reads things like Rilke, as do I, but this one was a clipping from Oprah's magazine instead of a book. Rilke says one day you'll awaken to realize you've lived your way into the answers. These are the words that come to mind here in my Lostine River sanctuary, staring at a mug of ice cubes and tonic water and gin with its chewed up lime floating atop. Testimony to the Swiss Army knife I didn't sharpen before leaving the house. I drink more often than I did when Brett and Zach were home, and I don't know why. No one in my family is a drinker, save my sister Dorinda, and I haven't seen her in years, only heard rumors, so even that is in question. Mom and Daddy certainly didn't raise us that way. Whether brain cell death by alcohol is my problem right now, I can't say, but there's no arguing the fact that I forgot to bring firewood. I also failed to pack a bucket for dousing embers, not to mention a shovel and axe, both required by law. I seem to have left home with nothing much beyond my desire to survive the sleeping part. giving little thought to provisions. I brought a carton of yogurt and a raw chicken breast in the igloo, but this fire I kindled from floor refuse has redwindled to a point no brighter than the very twilight I meant to fend off, certainly too Spartan for cooking. So I'm forced to hike the newly graded dirt road to look for firewood the Forest Service might have left. Rangers saw a windfall to get it off the roads, cut it into cordwood and kindling, and leave it stacked along the ditch. Most of it is delivered to primitive campsites such as this one, so the requisition comes guilt-free. This knowledge, one of the privileges of having been the sister-in-law of a park ranger in the American West. The other question to be raised at this point, I suppose, beyond why a 44-year-old woman is trying to fool herself into thinking camping alone is a means of disinheriting life's potential dangers, is why I left my biological family and home and came west in the first place. I could intellectualize it and say, as a child of the 1960s and 70s, sophisticated in ways my Kentucky kinfolk never had been by television and the Vietnam War and a public education and years and stacks of library books, by bomb shelters, the Beatles, Life magazine, and something new called frozen yogurt, that I simply was not intrigued by what the generations of my people had settled for. Hundreds of years of sequestered living in the hills and hollers of Kentucky. It is true, I watched most of the women of my lineage move through life dreamlike and wordless, the lines of their dresses listless and unimaginative, the furnishings in their homes largely without color except for small berry-dyed string roses attached to crocheted doilies and the spots in the linoleum where the bright still showed. My daddy's parents hung flowered wallpaper once, and that was pretty for a while, although smoke from the pot-bellied stove in the front room and the wood cook stove in the kitchen soon dulled it. I don't know how long it took, a winter, maybe two, maybe five. Who knows? Time is like Play-Doh to the mind of a child. But there was something else I had begun to sense early and even more intensely by the time I turned 12. It had to do with the deep mysteries that shrouded both sides of my family, the way my mother and her sisters and mother whispered among themselves, hushed when the men came in to wash for meals, the way when the women whispered one of them would be crying. It had to do with the way the men of my father's family told stories and the women didn't. It had to do with Mom and Daddy having raised me outside of Kentucky, of my being the subject of suspicion I did not understand, of feeling I was not accepted by this club of women who chopped tobacco and bared their flat breasts in the kitchen to nurse their many babies and butchered chickens and churned butter and went crazy or died before the age of 40, as if they were born having succumbed to fate, lacking all but imagined choices. Most of them still, in 1970, wore feed sack dresses, grew and slaughtered and canned everything that passed to their mouths from the table. Many of them couldn't read, but embroidered entire bedspreads with bluebirds. They danced in the spirit and spoke in tongues and laid hands for healing. And even though Mom and Daddy moved us to a 60-acre farm in the hills of southern Indiana, hoping, I guess, to provide us something better than they'd been provided, in my mind the trade was straight across, one mountain millstone for another. Mom still talks about milking the cows in the snow and how hard it was to live isolated with young children and without running water or even a well. Later, when I was 9, when they moved us to the town of New Albany, a seed spit across the Ohio River from Louisville, plunging us kids into the chaos of city schools, they still maintained our house on Red Bun Lane like it was in the hills. No flower bed landscaping for us, unless you count the whitewashed tire full of dirt and irises in the backyard, but plenty of wild honeysuckle and enough dead cars that now and then the city sent Daddy a polite letter asking him to license and insure them or haul them off. As for my part, I couldn't understand why the lot of my relatives still squatted in the same places they had for generations, watching old buckboards and rank-and-file storefront silver into dust. Why nobody wanted to get free of tobacco barns and man-high mules and round-nosed pickup trucks constantly in need of having a brake line bled or an inner tube patch picked up from town, which of course required walking miles of slate bottom creek and dirt road, or catching and hitching one of the mules. So I drove away in 1977 with my first husband Jeff and a 1964 Falcon station wagon full of dreams and belongings in a January snowstorm so cold and icy the Ohio River froze, that sludgy strip of floating barge traffic and steamboat races that separated New Albany, Indiana from Louisville, Kentucky, the place I was born, the first grandchild, the first baby on either side of my family not to be born in a Kentucky mountain shack. That marked me. The originality of the circumstances around my birth gave me internal and implied external obligations to do better than the rest of my family had, to do better than raising tobacco crops by walking behind the wide, shiny rump of a mule and the angled blade of a single tree plow, to do better than milking grade A dairy cows by hand, selling the skimmings to the local creamery, to do better than growing sugarcane for molasses, selling eggs, patching worn-out sleeves and knees, to do better than end with skin dark and leathery from days in the field, standing in the door frame whenever an automobile idled up to the house, the irises of my eyes so faded as to be visible to the driver. By the time I was 4 or 5 years old, I already knew I wasn't as hardy or hardy as those women behind me. For one thing, I only cared about the history ghosts that slipped around adult conversations, the things they didn't talk about that molded in me a skittishness like a deer's, a symptom in my gut like a constant wish. I want to know. I felt it when Mom's stepfather was in the room and her half-brother Paul, who was the black-haired and gold-toothed and took a bit of shrapnel in Vietnam. The only son, Mom cried, the only son, and he could have got out of going, but he didn't. Years later, Paul had a fit of post-traumatic stress, late-onset schizophrenia. Out came his deer rifle with a bayonet and a flashlight duct-taped to its barrel. Out came his Army-issue camouflage pants and coat. He was among the Viet Cong again. He smelled sniper fire. He threatened to kill anybody who came close. Got himself carted away from those Adair County hills to the VA hospital in Louisville. Miles and miles of county dirt road. Miles and miles of two-lane blacktop. Then finally, the expressway. Funny I never felt the deer stomach from my daddy's daddy, who spent time in prison for sexing one of the boarding girls from the wayward women's house his first wife's kin ran. It's hard to see the moon from certain Oregon backroads in the middle of June, especially if you're a 34-year-old woman on a scavenger hunt driving into the American Night on I-84, the east-west interstate between Portland, Oregon, and Boise, Idaho. Driving from motel to motel with a man you barely know, looking for his wife, a lissom blonde police trainee, and your husband, a police corporal. There are 43 motels pockmarking 120 miles of asphalt between LeGrand, Oregon and Kennewick, Washington. Some heavy with the exhaust of 18-wheelers idling in the parking lot. Some nondescript with two or more layers of door-studded cement floors and iron balcony railings. Some crumbly stucco places. Some pleasantly shingled with family rates and meager neon lights beckoning the highway. Some fairly elegant, after the New West fashion. There is much to occupy our talk and thinking on this June night in 1991, but my passenger, Joey Mundell, trim, athletic build, hair still mostly dark, is interested only in two things. The news I have just shared about a day in April when I happened to find his blonde wife, Tanya, making out with my gray at the temple's husband at a game preserve overlook outside Le Grand, where every manner of wildlife, from nesting falcons to an autocratic bull elk and a coquettish handful of cows, could be observed. That and the new panties he's recently given her. Frickin' black lace underwear, he says. Frickin' black lace French underwear, and she goes and does this. And as soon as we find their love nest, he's going to tear the place apart until he finds them to determine whether she's used them with my husband, Mark.
You've been listening to Paula Coomer, reading from her novel, Dove Creek.
All the oxen free, come out from behind the tree. You and I were meant to be. Naked, unashamed.
Dress your soul, mama.
You were always beautiful to me.
Dress your soul.
You were always beautiful.
Patricia Morrison is camped on the Lostien River at the entrance to a wilderness area in northeastern Oregon. She is reminiscing about the breakup of her marriage to Mark. She remembers driving from motel to motel, looking for him and a woman named Tanya. We hit every burg and side street, and it takes 9 hours, but we finally discover Tanya's car outside the Days Inn in Kennewick. It is 6 a.m. Joey has knocked on doors and shouted, and we have grilled the frightened desk clerk until the man has threatened to call the police. We promise to leave, head instead to the parking lot, crouch next to her silver Grand Am, exchanging the rhetoric of limbo and cuckolds. Daybreak, crazing the shadows, lifting the scent of sagebrush and evaporating dew. I tell him how Mark suddenly wanted a vasectomy, explain my missing teeth, the gaps that make me conscious of my genetics, pulled the previous week to uncrowd my mouth for braces, part of a beauty and weight loss plan designed to reignite my marriage. Joey weeps into his hands, said he cheated on her once while she was in the hospital birthing their first baby, that he deserves this. Still, neither of us wants what is taking place. Both wish for the courage to blow the two to smithereens. Turns out there is blood and death and plenty of it. There's the scene in the parking lot. At about 8:30 a.m., 2 hours after Joey and I settle our butts against the asphalt and our backs against a stone retaining wall, Mark walks down the stairs next to us dressed in neon green shorts and a luau shirt, snowy blue eyes covered in aviator shades. My police corporal husband burst into sobs. I told you I had demons to slay, he says. Then there is me, in my first display of violence ever, kicking open the flimsy hollow core door of room 322's fiberglass bathroom, yanking back the shower curtain, shoving my drenched opponent against the wall and into the soap scum. She is firm and girl-breasted, and not an ounce of her jiggles. Mark's ideal. Hello, bitch, I say, to which she answers, fat pig, to the background sounds of her husband, her high school sweetheart, thrashing and cussing and screaming his way through suitcases and duffel bags new enough to have been purchased for the occasion, looking for those black lace French underwear. Joey, no, she yells, no. And then there is Mark and me back in the parking lot, switching his things from her car to our black cherry Dodge Caravan, the heat of the morning sun sucking at my throat and chest, which are still shriveled from last night's panic and fear. I feel drained and vaguely pitying of this man I've willed myself to love despite his flaws, uncertain of the choice I'm about to make. Then, without warning, Joey gallops down the stairs, hefts open the trunk of his wife's car, finds it loaded with his own golf clubs, and goes berserk. He is clutching a trio of them in one fist, swinging, arcing overhead. The cuts they are making in the air sound like cross saws singing, like a zither. His face is red as a wound, and the sweat beads and dribbles from damp tendrils, his nose, his mustache. He is threatening to break a four iron over Mark's skull, and then it's me yelling, "Joey, no, no! You'll lose your job! We'll all lose our jobs! We'll get arrested!" He bashes the expensive clubs against the ground instead, swings at it and barely misses the car, swipes at the air again and again, failing to make purchase with anything solid. Once we all return home and start strewing our individual versions of the story, the dominoes come falling. A dispatcher, out of guilt apparently, admitting to an affair with another blue-suited city officer. Another police wife, giving in to her suspicions, discovering her husband with a teenage civilian neighbor. Somebody spilling the beans about yet another officer's liaison with a jail matron and the sequelae. One wife attempting suicide. Another developing unrelenting diarrhea and vomiting, resulting in a lengthy hospitalization and battle with anorexia. One officer's father-in-law taking a shotgun to his own face. The news mingled with that of his recent cancer diagnosis. Just a little too much to bear. And then there is Mark, usually blue-jeaned or uniformed, who begins wearing muscle pants and Hawaiian print shirts, and my own sudden, unquenchable thirst for black velvet and Diet Coke, and the tears of the children, 15 in all, dropped headfirst into the abyss of broken families with one single panic-filled stroke of some monster god's plot-making. "I always hoped this would never happen to us." Brett, his 10-year-old body having not yet taken on the pudgy, squared-off popsicle shape it will in the years after the divorce, says when I call him and Zach on the living room sofa to give him the news that their father and I are divorcing. Zach is only 7. They both look extra vulnerable with their newly shaven summer heads and arms and shoulders sticking out from tank tops, tanned and bony and slightly frog-muscled. And I still don't quite understand why in the weeks that followed, the four of us as a family drove the truck and camper up to this very campsite spot on the Lostine River and stayed, Friday through Sunday, thrice, stopping in a little town called Elgin on the way home, filing in to the old post office theater to watch Dances with Wolves and eat popcorn, all the while acting as if nothing is out of the ordinary. My response to the drama and disloyalty was to fold a glossy nursing magazine recruiting ad for the Indian Health Service into small squares and carry it around with me. I would take it out several times a day to sob into a Kleenex and stare at the handsome white doctor holding the Indian baby, admire the shaman-like gaze of the Indian nurse in white uniform and starched nurse's cap, then at night stand doing dishes and memorizing the Indian prayer taped in front of my face to our kitchen cupboard. O Great Spirit, whose voice I hear in the wind, I am small and meek, and need your courage and wisdom. I ran my finger over the pink-shadowed Indian reservations in the Rand McNally Road Atlas, calculated the distance to Lapway, Idaho, to the Nez Perce, Chief Joseph and his band of rebels. I had been to the Nez Perce Museum at Spalding, camped at Olicott in the Oregon Wallowas. I knew about the famous Nez Perce battle at Big Hole, Montana, and the failed flight toward freedom from the U.S. Army, was moved to emotion by stories of the Nez Perce tribe's stamina and statuesque resolve. I imagined absorbing their strong will as my own bravery. The Nez Perce reservation was near enough for Brett and Zach to see Mark regularly, yet too far for those demon blue eyes to charm me back into their grip. And as fate or luck would have it, there was an opening for a public health nurse at Lapway. The road seemed to fork two ways. I could pack my children and a few possessions and head back toward the hellfire and brimstone of my Kentucky heritage, or bank my salvation yet again on whatever remained undiscovered about the wilds of the American West and its propensity, at least in my mind, to challenge and grow those who heed the forces of its unseen call. Before I drove to the U.S. Forest Service office just outside La Grande, where my soon-to-be ex-brother-in-law was a forest ranger, to pick up an SF-171, the application for federal hire, I decided Brett, Zach, and I would take a trip to Lapway, Idaho, to see whether I wanted to work there. Part of me hissed that I was truly only a white flower child wannabe lunatic brainwashed by films like Billy Jack, raving about Indian rights with Mark's wine-soused conservative Republican cop buddies over metal ring campfires in places named for famous Indians. The more silent part of me tickled the ratios of my blood quantum. Mom's mother's parents were Cherokee, and Daddy had a Cherokee grandfather. A set of great-grandparents on his side were slaves. I imagined myself on a mission from the great Creator to merge this array of spirits and colors sent in the way of Luke Skywalker or Joan of Arc. I tried to discuss my family's heritage with people during that first touring visit, but was met with a silent, deflated look. Luckily, my future office mate, a famous Nez Perce fancy dancer named Leonard Wahoban, took me aside and politely explained that it was a joke to Indians, the way every white person has Cherokee blood. But, he said, not many pictured themselves to be a great healer. Perhaps I was, as the ancient Hopi prophesied, a Hopi medicine man reborn in the body of a white person. It was projected to happen near the time of the end of the earth. I laughed, of course, despite feeling very confused, and always since heeded Leonard's couched warning, but it annoyed me to be forced to deny my family's blood mix just because some wild-eyed creeps had come before me. So I thanked him for the advice, also explaining in no uncertain terms that I was familiar with the calamity displacement brings to a people because, as a newly separated woman and a Native American and an African and a Scottish descendant, I was, after all, a wad of displaced people myself. I furthermore stated that both my grandmothers and my mother looked decidedly Indian, which affected the way they were treated by the white community and therefore the way they treated themselves and each other, which affected the way they treated me. Leonard didn't say another word. Only grinned that shit-eating grin I would come to know and suspect, as I went on to tell how my father's mother's family settled a sizable parcel of southern Kentucky, 109 acres to which my daddy still holds the deed, and that we had stewarded that bloody ground since the tribes were heartlessly curried off of it. As late as the 1960s, my grandpa Darnell Morrison picked arrowheads churned from walking behind a mule and the handles of a plow, and despite offers, refused to sell a single one. He had a sackcloth full of them, so heavy my then juvenile arms could barely lift it. That it was this sense of solemn responsibility that bid me place the Indian prayer on my cupboard, right next to a recruiting ad for nurses in the Army National Guard. Be all that you can be. Whatever the West meant for me, it meant something else entirely for the hemisphere's earlier inhabitants. The Nahuatl, or Aztecs, referred to Tlaloc, the West, as Xipe-Totec, or water, which also stands for courage. Another translation of Tlaloc also means blood of the earth. The West to the Salish-speaking tribes of the inland Northwest was a place of physical endings and spiritual beginnings, a place of crossing the great water. In a book I read by Joseph Eppes Brown called The Sacred Pipe, Black Elk of the Sioux tells the story of how white buffalo calf woman delivered the message of the medicinal pipe to Chief Standing Hollow Horn. Chief Standing Hollow Horn seated her in the place of honor, the West. For in sitting in the West, one faces East, from which comes the light of the sun's fire, representing wisdom and illumination a leader must always possess if he is to guide his people in a sacred manner. The Sioux also believed the spiritual road, the Good Red Road, ran east to west, and the Blue Road, what Christian teaching refers to as the wide paved highway, the carnal or material road, ran north to south, the two intersecting as a cross. There comes a time in every life, no matter what direction you originally choose, when you reach the crossroads and must decide east-west or north-south. It is also in the West, according to Sioux mythology, that a buffalo was placed in order to hold back the waters. Every year, the buffalo loses one hair, and with every age of man, he loses one leg. When all his hair and legs are gone, the waters will rush back in and a cycle of human history comes to an end, and with it, a return to primordial spirituality. Many tribes believe the buffalo is on his last leg and is nearly bald. The Hopi believe the spirits of Hopi medicine men will be born into white children in an effort to spread healing to those who would initiate the end of the age. Fire is a wicked thing. Wicked as the foil-colored waters below my feet. The night is a black ghost and the noise of white water its veil, and I long for something to distract me from thinking about whatever other life forms might be pacing nearby. And I know from experience that I can spend eons cloaked between the gray atmospheres of dusk, staring into a fire, letting its heat delude me into fearlessness. I listen to the water, its rush urgent and syncopated. But to stand here too many more minutes is to have the sound pull me closer, is to not get the fire built while I can still see. And I do need to face what the fire will conjure for me. Because tonight's fire is a hallway into my past. It is a corridor to my daydreams from my 20s and 30s. Those long nights and days spent distracting myself with an imagined life apart from the one saddling me with wife and baby care duties. Mark and Brett and Zach were tantalizing human prisms, things that shed glorious colored light. On bad days, I dripped tears like some tree with its limbs cut off, for the world passing time without my part in it, for whatever hippies still danced at Haight Ashbury, whatever poets still read in Greenwich Village. I thought of Sylvia Plath. But to end my life in my 20s, to give up contributing to the pool of lust or knowledge or ignorance, to leave Plath's legacy for my children, was worse than they deserved. And what sacrilege to have generated those thoughts while sitting on this very mountain perch, stirring embers, feeling the edges of pitch darkness, Brett and Zach struggling against the tide of bedtime.
You've been listening to Paula Coomer, reading from her novel, Dove Creek.
All the holy oxen free, come out from behind the tree. You and I were meant to be. Naked and ashamed.
Dress your soul, mama.
You were always beautiful to me.
Dress your soul.
You were always beautiful.
Dove Creek was produced by Nancy Casey and Paula Coomer with help from KRFP, a listener-supported non-commercial radio station at 92.5 FM in Moscow, Idaho. You can find KRFP on the web at krfp.org, where you can click on Dove Creek to learn more about this broadcast, sign up for a podcast, or send an email. There you can also contact Bill Finch, who wrote and performs our theme song.